We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast. John McKechnie here in studio. And I'm talking, of course, with Mario Puig. There is a lot to get to today. Obviously, things have been absolutely insane since the last time that we recorded for a big, wide variety of reasons today. We're going to try to keep it focused on the football side of things, with the NFL opting to keep on moving as far as its new year schedule is concerned, and starting the new league year with the legal tampering period opening up on Monday, and then with things supposedly going official later on today, Wednesday, when we're recording. But first of all, Mario, how's it going?
Oh, pretty good, John. How are you doing?
Been pretty bored these last few days, but you know, that's better than most of the alternatives. So I mean, been able to digest a fair bit of this NFL news, so I'm ready to get into it.
Yeah, I'm just like at this point a brain with cords attached to it. The cords go to the TVs and like internet devices, and I'm okay like this. I guess most people it might not suit, like someone like you who goes outside. I'm built for this, and it comes naturally to me. So yeah, I've got all the numbers, all the football things are just plugged directly into my brain, and I can copy and paste them into this podcast now.
Beautiful. Well, I'm clicking Control C in that case here. Let's open things up with the biggest news of this cycle here, and that would be the Tom Brady decision to not only leave New England but to go to Tampa Bay, initials TB, so the brand synergy, tremendous.
Whoa.
Yeah, right? And who knows what's going to happen with him wearing number 12. I mean, I imagine he'll just give Chris Godwin a pretty penny for that number, but I mean, what is your reaction there? Like, what did you expect going into this, and what did you make of the landing spot? I mean, there were, you know, a few suitors that fell off over the course of the final few days there. It felt like it was like a 50-50. He's either going back to New England or with some of the suitors dropping out, like the Chargers. It felt like Tampa Bay really rose to the top of that list there. So what were your thoughts overall?
I kind of understand why Bruce Arians wanted to go this way, and in so far as I understand, you know, the sort of calculation he's trying to make. Like, it's Jameis Winston is the sort of extreme version of recklessness in a quarterback, and you know, the embodiment of unreliability. And having gone through all the stress of those 40 turnovers or whatever, and all the inconceivable ups and downs, it makes sense for Bruce Arians to gravitate toward what he thinks is stability, you know, the polar opposite of Jameis Winston. And for whatever it's worth, good or bad, Tom Brady is exactly that. But that comes with some downside, too. It's like Jameis Winston, for all his issues, he's willing and somewhat capable of chucking the ball downfield, which suits the skill set of Mike Evans. And obviously they worked well with Chris Godwin last year. But with Tom Brady, there's just the simple reality that Bruce Arians needs to adjust his offense for Tom Brady to work in it. Because if you try to put Tom Brady out there and just call the same plays, like, don't get me wrong, it might have a better war result than Jameis Winston in that role, but it's still not going to quite work on rhythm. There's still going to be there's going to be times where Brady's basically forced to throw the ball away or throw it further downfield than he's capable of. And so Bruce Arians will have to be more pragmatic than he's ever been. And given the O.J. Howard incident from last year, I don't have much reason to believe Arians is capable of pragmatism. But, a kind of humbling experience like last year could, to be fair, be the kind of thing that gets even a stubborn person to reexamine their methods.
Yeah, so I think having Brady there is such a crazy turn of events for him that you would have to imagine, if he's willing to go that far, that you have to imagine he's also willing to change some things up about the way he's going to go about things.
Yeah, maybe Jameis Winston was so traumatic to Bruce Arians that Bruce Arians actually hates throwing downfield now. Maybe he's like, I'm a West Coast offense guy now. And if that's the case, then yeah, I guess Tom Brady could work. He won't make as many stupid throws as Winston, like that we can take for granted several times over. The question is, especially in Mike Evans's case, I think, like, how will his application look in the offense with Brady there? Because Brady still, when he gets a clean pocket and when he's got the defense fully read on a play, even the last 2 years, he's made some nice downfield throws. The problem is he hasn't shown the ability in the past couple of years to do it from the typical look. Like, he needs everything perfectly lined up to make those kinds of throws. And there's no reason to think, especially if the Tampa Bay offense maintains the pass attempt volume that it has, like, he's just going to have to make throws from situations that he's not necessarily comfortable in. And when he's in those situations, is he going to chuck it at Evans anyway and hope for the best, or will he be more check down prone than Winston was? And I think it's the second one. Like, I think Mike Evans will be fine. Like, I want to be clear about that, but he has that kind of 1400 yard, 1500 yard upside in a Jameis Winston offense. I think in a Brady offense, it's probably liable to be capped at 1300.
So
that,
I mean,
could, oh,
to,
sorry.
To put your feet to the fire here a little bit, then, I mean, there was like a little bit of hot takiness last summer to, like, do you like Chris Godwin more than Mike Evans? But, like, now I think that with the infusion of Brady into this offense and the presumed, you know, toning down of the downfield element to this offense, at least to an extent here. I mean, if you look at the average depth of throw for both of those quarterbacks, Jameis Winston 10.7, that's second in the league last year among qualified quarterbacks. Brady 8.1, which is, you know, to contextualize it, that's in Kyle Allen land. So I think that maybe there is a legitimate chance that Godwin is the receiver to have in Tampa Bay for fantasy, though.
Yeah, I think there's I wouldn't argue against someone keeping Evans first between the two, but I agree with you. I would probably have to lean toward Godwin because he's just really, really good. Like, there's a non-zero chance that Godwin, a few years from now, we look back and we say, yeah, he was better than Evans. We might say Godwin was a top 4 or 5 receiver in the league all this time, a few years from now, for all we know. So given how good he's been for his own part, and given that he just objectively operates more consistently and at a uniquely high level in the part of the field that Brady is thrown to for the past couple of years, it just feels like there's less risk with him. Mm-hmm. And I think there could be a scenario where Evans is, like, totally fine. And maybe there's even a possibility of something like fewer turnovers in the Tampa Bay offense means more, first downs, longer drives, more scoring opportunities. Like maybe Evans gets capped at 1,200 yards, but maybe he catches, 10 more passes because his depth of target goes down and his difficulty of a catch on any given target gets lowered. And maybe he just does fine with that. But if there's not that kind of like reliable 12 to 14 touchdown upside, then especially in PPR scoring, it just seems like Evans is kind of working at a handicap relative to Godwin, who seems like a shoe-in for 90 plus catches in this sort of look.
Yeah, I think so too. So, I enjoy aesthetically, I love like a Mike Evans type, just like dominating down the sideline type of thing. But at this stage, I just do feel like the Brady fit is more so with Chris Godwin. And, so we talk about the two primary targets in this offense, and you figure that these guys both are going to be pushing well into the triple digits as far as targets for this season goes. But another, key staple of Brady in years past, and maybe that's based on personnel and them not being able to find a great outside receiver to complement Julian Edelman, Brady has leaned on the tight ends and the running backs as, his security blankets here. And we talked about the checkdowns. Does this bolster, an OJ Howard? Can we like pull ourselves out of the rubble and like buy back in on OJ Howard? Does this boost Ronald Jones's stock as a PPR candidate? I saw him, kind of get tossed in as one of the core guys in this offense. I'm not necessarily sold on that. I could see them going after a running back in this class here. So what do you make of the other options in this Tampa Bay offense now?
It's tough because I still like OJ Howard a lot, but I just don't know if the Arians offense can use him to the best of his abilities. The Arians offense, the way it's generally worked, has been a three receiver base, and the tight end is there to largely block. The tight end is there as a safety measure. It's not an attacking measure. Like the tight end in the Arians offense is supposed to help out with an offensive tackle if there's a problematic edge rushing threat. And other than that, he's supposed to be a like 6 yard downfield check down option for the quarterback. And that's why you saw Cameron Brate get so many more targets per snap, get more work as a pass catcher, run more routes generally per snap than OJ Howard. OJ Howard, I think, is very good, but I think you need to use him as more like a seam threat tight end. I don't think it's really in his strengths to use him on curl routes underneath. He's not, admittedly, he does not have the best hands of a tight end. Like the way he hurts a defense is by presenting a big catch radius that moves fast down the field. And especially in a context of an offense like this, I feel like that should work normally because the safeties have to choose which way they want to lose in that case. They have to choose, like, do I want to help on Evans? Do I want to help on Godwin? I can't help on all three of these people. And OJ Howard at 6'6", 250 is actually faster than Mike Evans. So send him downfield, make the defense chase him. And if they don't, chuck the ball downfield and watch him, be too fast and huge to be stopped in that case. But Arians just kept him shallow for the most part, and he's not good at that. And I think you could see the Arians offense wants to use a tight end more like Brate than like Howard, because Howard, you have to use more like a wide receiver. And for whatever reason, Bruce Arians just wouldn't consider using OJ Howard simply as a wide receiver. It would make more sense to just have a three receiver set of OJ Howard outside, Mike Evans outside, and Chris Godwin in the slot than what they did last year. But I don't think there's a serious chance of that happening. So maybe Brady is good for Howard in that Brady throws more to the tight end than Winston did. But I still feel like it's just like not using Howard correctly. If you use Howard correctly, you have him running far downfield. You don't have him blocking that much. Athletically, he should be considered similar to someone like Vincent Jackson, but because of his technical tight end classification, Arians just can't think of using him like that.
Yeah, it's been obviously a frustrating run as for the OJ Howard believers, you and I, but maybe this will get things turned around. I'm not going to hold my breath on it, but I mean, I agree with your overall breakdown on what Howard brings to the table.
Yeah, sorry, I will say that I can imagine Tom Brady kind of offsetting his downfield throwing issues by making a special effort to target guys who have a size advantage over who's covering them. And Howard, you know, for as much as he might not be the short area coordination guy to catch a quick tight end screen and, you know, run away with grace after the catch, he probably is a really good just toss the ball up and see if he can get it kind of guy. And I think Brady, he understands defensive leverage really well. And if he sees Howard with a linebacker on him and the linebacker's back is turned, I can imagine Brady just chucking it at him in those cases, because his downfield accuracy is suffering, yes, but with the kind of catch radius that a guy like O.J. Howard has, and if O.J. Howard is running from the middle of the field where he's nearer yet to Tom Brady, it's kind of like missing a barn, you know, the broadside of a barn at that point. It's like, it's even if you're inaccurate, Howard's such a hulking figure who can cover so much ground. It's just put it somewhere away from the defense and see if Howard is the only one who can get to it.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. If you're looking for a credit card that fits your lifestyle, look no further. U.S. Bank has credit cards that make every day rewarding, no matter what you're into. Feeling hungry? Check out the U.S. Bank Altitude Go Visa Signature Card. Earn 4x points on takeout, food delivery, and dining. And get 2x points at gas stations, grocery stores, and on streaming. That'll keep your wallet and your mouth full. Big spender? The U.S. Bank Visa Platinum Card has a low intro APR for large purchases or balance transfers. And you call the shots with the U.S. Bank Cash Plus Visa Signature Card. Choose two categories each quarter. Earn 5% back on your first $2,000 of eligible purchases from those categories. So don't just get a credit card. Get the right card to make every day more rewarding. Cash back, merchandise, travel rewards, and low intro APRs are waiting. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. The creditor and issuer of these cards is U.S. Bank National Association, pursuant to a license from Visa USA, Inc., and the cards are available to United States residents only. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
All right, let's move our discussion on over to the big trade that occurred as the new league year opened up, and that, of course, between the Texans and the Cardinals, with the Texans out of kind of nowhere, shipping off DeAndre Hopkins, arguably a top three at the very least receiver in the league, and in the process getting an immensely light return. So they trade away Hopkins in a fourth, and the Texans received David Johnson, and they took on all of his salary, I believe, a second round pick and a 2021 fourth round pick. So an immensely light return for the Texans for a legitimate franchise wide receiver. And now Hopkins moves from one of the, you know, very exciting young quarterbacks in the league to another one who you know, we still haven't even seen close to what his ceiling looks like. And that's Kyler Murray. So let's just do an autopsy of this trade here. What do you think of it? I think the listeners need a Mario Bill O'Brien rant.
Well, unfortunately, it's not that complicated. You know, this is just one of those open and shut cases where this guy is incompetent, and he's like malignantly incompetent. Like, because particularly if this report from Michael Irvin that came out today is true, basically Bill O'Brien said, or at least Michael Irvin is claiming, that DeAndre Hopkins told him that Bill O'Brien said some rancid stuff. And it was otherwise reported by other people well before today that Hopkins and Bill O'Brien did not get along. And that's kind of the starting point that you need to vaguely rationalize this trade, and not even rationalize, explain it. Like, it's still a stupid thing to do. It's petty, it's childish, it's irresponsible, it's reckless. But Bill O'Brien is all of those things, so he's able to justify the trade in his mind on that basis. But it still is objectively stupid management from a resource perspective, because he traded DeAndre Hopkins, who, you know, he's worth like two first rounders or something like that.
Yes.
And he traded DeAndre Hopkins for what could generously be described as like a second round pick and David Johnson. But you have to understand, David Johnson was a toxic asset in this trade. It was not a plus, it was a negative. Bill O'Brien was either too stupid to see it for that, or he didn't care because he was just so petty on a personal level toward Hopkins that it was immaterial to him that he was taking a loss in his job as an asset manager. So he's either stupid or he's just malignantly reckless, and it's just I don't even really know what there is to say beyond that, because he apparently has Houston's ownership at his back. They're just willing to let him do whatever he wants. And I have to assume they're okay with this too, because they seem to just like him more with every fire that he sets. But it'll hurt the Houston offense. It'll hurt Deshaun Watson. I guess it's good for Will Fuller, Kenny Stills, and Randall Cobb, who they signed at $9 million a year over 3 years. I don't really think that it's going to be a consistent offense, though, because it wasn't one last year when it had DeAndre Hopkins. And Bill O'Brien has some of the most predictable route combinations, some of the worst just offensive play calling theory in the NFL. And it's going to be a lot of games like the Carolina game last year, I think, where in the Denver game, where it's like Deshaun Watson drops back to pass, no one's open. They spend the first half just getting kicked around, and then in the second half, Deshaun Watson starts running because he has no choice, and they kind of make some comebacks. They go like 8-8 because Deshaun Watson's an awesome quarterback. But they're not going to be good, and they're not going to meaningfully compete. And they wouldn't have competed all these past years with O'Brien if it wasn't for that division just kind of being crap and Andrew Luck retiring and being hurt. So maybe the division stays bad and O'Brien somehow keeps kind of treading water. But
yeah, he's doing the mainstay of that first game on Saturday of Wild Card Weekend. So that's like his like Las Vegas residency show.
Yes, it is. And maybe it's going to go another year, but we'll see. That team is going – there's no way that team respects him. There's no way. DeAndre Hopkins was a highly regarded player. He wasn't some kind of like Odell Beckham. Like, I think it's okay to be a diva like Odell Beckham, but DeAndre Hopkins was not a diva by any stretch of the imagination. So I think that it's going to be the kind of thing where it's going to have a morale sort of repercussion. Like, these guys are pros. They're going to go out there and play, but they're not going to play with inspiration. They're not going to reach that 110% sort of level that you can when you have that sort of like just, you know, inspired adrenaline going through you. Like, no one will fight for this guy. And, you know, Deshaun Watson, he's basically, you know, a soldier on the field. He's going to compete. He can't help it. That's just who he is. But I hope he doesn't resign there. And in the meantime, I'm expecting a regression this year. Still good, but in an article that I wrote on the site a couple days ago about projecting the remaining Houston offense, I wrote how he was going three rounds behind Pat Mahomes and about one round ahead of Kyler Murray and Russell Wilson. I would put him at this point behind certainly Kyler Murray, in no small part because of Hopkins going there, but also Russell Wilson and Dak Prescott. So I don't have any Watson shares at this point. I'm not exactly motivated to go get them, but we'll see how low the price gets. He obviously will run. He will obviously raise the baseline of that offense just because he is an elite quarterback or close to it. But anytime you take the leading efficiency and volume guy from an offense like Houston did by trading DeAndre Hopkins, you destabilize the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think also you run into the scenario, and obviously this year has a very deep receiver class, but you can't just only rely on rookies to, you know, make up the number three and number four volume of targets in your offense there. And, you know, once you look at that receiving core with like – without Hopkins, I mean, I like Fuller, but I think we can both agree that the durability concern is real, and Stills is good when he's out on the field too. But, you know, you'd prefer to have way more depth than that. So, I mean, again, this trade just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I think that at the very least you can characterize this receiving core as being on thin ice. Like, if something goes wrong and they have to give more meaningful snaps to some, you know, very, very questionable 53-man roster type of receivers, that's going to be an even bigger issue, an even bigger obstacle for Watson and this offense to overcome as a whole.
Yeah, I think they're going to go into the year with DeAndre Carter as the fourth receiver, Cobb as the slot, Fuller and Stills the general presumed starters. They don't have a pick until the 40th overall in the second round, so they're not in at all range to get like they can't get a probable starting candidate at receiver, and I don't think they intend to take one. Like, they're so short on resources. They got to replace DJ Reader somehow. They had plenty of questions as it was at kind of just like at the defensive line generally, like they don't have much going on there. The offensive line, of course, is not great. So it's a roster that's not good enough to be giving up assets like they have, and to get rid of their best player and still have no pick until 40th overall just shows like this is an insolvent team. Like this is botched. This is not how it was supposed to work. No matter what Bill O'Brien says, this is basically a meltdown as an institution. So I think Stills and Fuller are good players. It's just that Hopkins was a guy who, and it's rare to find players like this, but Hopkins is a guy who could lead your team in efficiency and take on a staggering volume. And normally when you take on the volume that Hopkins had in Houston, you kind of sink to the baseline of the offense because you are the baseline. Like you make the floor of the offense yourself. And so it's unfair to expect you to outperform everybody else in terms of efficiency. It's easier to have a high efficiency grade over a smaller sample where you can, you know, spike it upward with a few good plays. Like Hopkins didn't have that benefit, and yet he still established the efficiency high mark too. So when you take that away, you find out how good everybody else is, and the answer is going to be even if Fuller, even if Stills are quite good, and I think they are. I like both of those guys, but you don't replace a player like Hopkins. You just don't do it.
You really don't. So let's talk about Hopkins and his new landing spot with the Cardinals. I think everyone is going to be throwing themselves at the Cardinals skill position guys now. I think, you know, Hopkins, you know, I don't think that this necessarily changes his like first round status in drafts, but I think it solidifies it. I think that the offense itself is going to be better, even if there's a slight downgrade at quarterback. But with everything around him, like I think that Kyler Murray is very legitimate QB3 this, as in, like, you know, behind Jackson and Mahomes. I think that there's a legitimate argument to be made for Kyler Murray being the third quarterback off the board in drafts this year.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And I don't know, I haven't thought enough about how much I think I'm willing to pay for him, but it's one of those things where when I try to be objective about it and think about the best case scenario with Murray, I have trouble ruling many things out because he was quite good as a rookie, even though everything was stacked against him. The offensive line was bad. The receivers, even on the offense where they ran more routes than any other team, where receivers logged more snaps than any other team by far, they still had some of the worst receivers in the league overall, and especially in terms of that like initial 3-4 wide receiver loadout, because Fitzgerald and Kirk, they're good. But Kirk was coming back from a broken foot. I don't think he was quite right all year. I still think he's going to be very good, and I think Fitz still offers something in the meantime. But going from a 4-wide base of, what was it, Demir Berg, Keyshawn Johnson, Christian Kirk, and Larry Fitzgerald to more of a 3-wide receiver offense or a 4-wide of, you know, Kirk, Fitz, Hopkins and Isabella or something like that, or even Demir Bird, if he's still the other guy out there, he's fast, whatever, that's fine. He can make the safety run back a little bit. But that's upgrading so many snaps and targets just with Hopkins alone joining them. And if Isabella can make a little bit of growth going into his second year, if Farrell Cooper or somebody, they've got these guys now who clearly offer something. And in the case of Kirk, you can, I think, count on more upside as he goes into his age 23 season. And if the foot cooperates anyway. So if Hopkins is there and Kirk and Fitzgerald are on the field, it's just one of those things where Kyler's going from maybe the worst overall average grade of wide receiver quality in an offense that demands more snaps of receivers than any other to an offense that demands more receiver snaps than any other and has among the best receiver snaps in the league. Mm-hmm. So he had the season that he did last year. And also it's like there's a chance with that 8th overall pick, the Cardinals could add a really good rookie tackle in this class. So there's a lot to like about Kyler Murray. And the other thing to keep in mind is the Arizona offense was basically bad last year. They Kyler Murray put up some good numbers and he had some really good moments, but they had so many three and outs. They were so inconsistent. And so even though they ran that max tempo offense, they didn't rank all that high in terms of plays logged. But with Kyler going into his second year, and especially if they add a good tackle upgrade in the draft, having DeAndre Hopkins and hopefully a little bit more healthy, a little bit more skilled version of Christian Kirk, that's setting up so many more first downs than last year, and that leads them to probably, I think this year, rank first in the league in plays logged because of that tempo. Because of that tempo being supplemented with actual first downs, it means that they're going to keep getting more chances to throw the ball, whatever it is, run the ball. And I think they're going to rank first in the league in snaps logged this year, and probably by an unprecedented margin.
Dang. All right. That's a strong statement, but I mean, I can definitely see it. And I mean, it's hard to come up with arguments really against this offense failing.
It basically lets
under Cliff.
Yeah, basically the Hopkins trade, and especially if Kirk can step forward, and especially if Isabella and Cooper can offer a little bit too, it makes the air raid theoretically realized. Like practically realized, I should say. Like, they had the theory of it last year, but they didn't have the practical means of making it happen. Now they do.
And, you know, that could be scary, because I think it teams, even though, you know, the Cardinals didn't end up having a great season by any means last year, by the time they started to get things in rhythm, and obviously, like you said, there are still shortcomings, they weren't a comfortable team to play against down the stretch there. So now, if they started to find their groove with a very ragtag bunch of receivers, you know, what does happen when you have Christian Kirk entering year three and Hopkins still in his prime, and Fitzgerald just a timeless and reliable guy in out of the slot, this guy just does kind of feel like the limit there. And, you know, that division is murder right now. But I think that you could almost see the Cardinals jumping over the Rams in the pecking order starting this year.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, check this out, though. Not only is DeForest Buckner no longer in the division, and watch that hurt the 49ers a lot more than people expect, but the Rams defense has been basically destroyed. So like Mikel Roby Coleman's gone. They might lose Fowler in free agency. They haven't yet, but they might. Brockers is gone. Aaron Donald is really the only thing on that deep. Corey Littleton signed with the Raiders. It's just Aaron Donald on that defense right now. And that, to be fair, Aaron Donald in himself is basically an average defense, even if you put like 10 clowns on the field otherwise. But they were specifically like a high pressure, high turnover defense before, and I don't think that's going to be the case anymore.
Yeah, so things could get a little dicey for the Rams here in a hurry.
No Wade Phillips either, yeah.
Yeah, that's bad. Let's move on over to the other big receiver trade here that happened. It felt like the way that Stephon Diggs was posting that this was a long time coming.
A full year of great posts. Someone should make a drill book, but just the Stephon Diggs tweets of the past year.
Instagram's also quality too. So, I mean, just a lot of interesting stuff. And you had a great line in your mock draft. It was like, oh, maybe the Vikings would have considered Trevon Diggs in this spot, but things happened. So I thought that was
That would be hilarious if they drafted him.
Just doubling down on the Diggs family. Why not? Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts here. So the Bills were obviously willing to pony up a lot of capital in order to go and get Stephon Diggs and really round out their receiving core to continue to build things around Josh Allen as he enters year three here. So they gave up a first rounder for this year, a fifth rounder, and a sixth round pick in 2021. So that's a fair amount, especially the 2020 first round pick, and how it stands in stark contrast, because I think we both like Stephon Diggs, but he's not as good as DeAndre Hopkins. And for him to command more in a trade, I don't think that the 2 year age gap or whatever it is worth it where Diggs is that first round type of acquisition, and Hopkins only nets you a second.
Yeah, and it's not to not to hold like a morbid detail over Diggs's head, but he does have a very long concerning injury history.
Right.
So he doesn't offer the workhorse specific upside that Hopkins has. Like, Hopkins is truly rare for the workhorse abilities that he has as a receiver, whereas Diggs, he's maybe a more dangerous player on a given play than DeAndre Hopkins, but he doesn't. He can't shoulder a load like the way Hopkins can. And for the Bills, that's fine, because they're not a high volume passing game anyway. And Diggs, if he's okay with, Josh Allen's scattershot accuracy, then they have the pieces of an overall dangerous offense, and Brian Daboll, I think, has done a great job the entire time that he's been in Buffalo. So I expect him to do a great job this year too. But I can't. What I can't tell is whether I think Diggs's fantasy situation is as good as it was in Minnesota. I don't think it is, because even though he only had 94 targets in 15 games last year, and that being the case with Thielen missing time, I just think that in Buffalo, it's one of those things. Like, John Brown's already there. He's not going to just disappear now that Diggs is there. Cole Beasley and Dawson Knox are decent enough. They're going to draw some targets. But it's just not an offense that aspires to throw the ball a whole lot. And Minnesota's wasn't exactly, you know, an air raid themselves, but it's a little bit more run heavy. Yet in Buffalo, cold weather does not correlate well to passing games generally. So you can just kind of imagine these things helping bring Diggs back to his baseline after averaging 12 yards a target last year. That is not sustainable. He was more of like an 8.5 yards per target kind of guy his career before last year.
Dipped below, like, the last 2 years have been very strange, because he was 6.9 yards per target in 2018.
Yeah, I also don't really have a good reason why his target count fell so much when Thielen was healthy all of 2018, where he had Diggs had 149 targets in 2018 and versus 94 last year. So
in the same amount of games.
Yeah, and when considering the change from Minnesota to Buffalo, it's like you got to keep in mind that even though it was 94 targets last year, that 149 still did happen in 2018. So I kind of like split the difference between the two. And then when I look at a projection of whatever, like 120 targets in the Minnesota offense versus, I'm guessing he's going to get about 100 targets in Buffalo. It's like, I would rather have the 110 targets in Minnesota, you know? So, between what I think will be a decrease in long-term target volume, colder weather, worse accuracy from the quarterback, and Diggs's injury history, I feel like he has a pretty low floor, and that's both on the season and certainly on a week-to-week basis. So he's kind of very close, actually, for me, to Will Fuller in the ADP now, or in my rankings now. I don't know where the ADP is going to go. I would imagine Diggs slides a little bit, but not much. And Fuller, of course, will go up. I don't know how much. People kind of hate him. He's kind of their new Sammy Watkins or something. So they might not buy in as much as the projections tell them to. But Diggs is basically Will Fuller to me as a fantasy asset right now.
So just to like play devil's advocate a little bit here, and you know, are way more attuned to like the ADP market, especially at this stage of the game here. But I just feel like maybe I'm just speaking as the donkey here, but when Diggs goes somewhere and he, you know, the team spends a first rounder to get him, maybe there's some optimism that Josh Allen continues to improve in year three, so on so forth, that maybe the ADP and getting away from, you know, the perception that comes along with Kirk Cousins being, you know, that is boring check down type of quarterback, even while you ignore the yards per target that Diggs had a year ago, maybe that ADP stays the same, or maybe even goes up a little bit.
Yeah, it could happen. I haven't like looked at Twitter to see what people are chattering about it. I saw some people more positive than others, but I didn't really see a decisive trend to emerge. So Diggs might just be one of those players who you have to be very high on him to draft him as a general rule, just because maybe there's two or three people in every draft who are way higher on him than everybody else, and maybe they're going to outbid you every time if you don't specifically make a reach by your standards. And that's totally possible, because in redraft, for instance, I have no real interest in Diggs at his sort of fifth round price tag from before. If he fell to the sixth, and especially the seventh, then I would be interested, I guess. But again, it's like the Will Fuller alternative is something that's compelling to me. I think there's reason to give Fuller a better projection generally, and the reason Fuller is always cheap is because of these inconsistency reasons that I think could just as easily apply to Diggs. So you could imagine, I guess, people thinking like, oh, well, Diggs was so great downfield last year, Josh Allen, yeah, he's going to get better, and he's already good at throwing the ball downfield. He worked so well with John Brown, and Diggs is even better. Diggs is not a similar player to John Brown, especially. Like, John Brown is a burner. Diggs is just like a 4-5 guy who's really good at running routes. So I don't even know if we can take for granted that he's going to get open downfield that much. I think it might be more like Cole Beasley who suffers for Diggs' arrival. But I don't think it's correct to project growth for Josh Allen. Like, he could make better decisions with experience, but his accuracy will not improve. It's not up to him. He can't do it. You don't have like the ability to improve accuracy as a general rule, or at least when you're as far along in your career as Allen is, the footwork or mechanical issues that might explain inaccuracy have been addressed as much as they can. Mm-hmm. And he won't get better. Like, he might make better decisions. He might take better risks that are more worth taking, and that could show up in the box scores of Diggs or Brown, but it's not likely enough, in my opinion, to make it worth paying the price that it takes to find out, especially if I can get Fuller in the eighth or something.
Yeah, exactly. You're always able to buy like the Fuller on the lower end of his price, so that's part of the brand. We talked about how the Houston receiving core might be a little bit on thin ice. And yeah, I did forget Randall Cobb, but you mentioned him earlier. When you look at this Vikings pass catching group now,
not good.
Woof. Yeah. So what happens now?
I don't know, but that they have Kyle Rudolph and Irv Smith there might hint that they're going more to tight end base offense. I haven't seen any comment. I haven't seen like Mike Zimmer comment on that. It's just, I don't know what else they're supposed to do now, kind of thing. And I also don't know what they're going to do in the draft. They have two first round picks, but it's just like, I they have enough needs at, or at least looming needs at defensive end and defensive tackle that you could imagine them having a higher priority at that position. They definitely have a more urgent need at corner. It remains to be seen whether they re-sign Mackenzie Alexander, but all of Xavier Rhodes, Trey Waynes, Mackenzie Alexander, Trey Waynes and Mackenzie Alexander were free agents, and they cut Rhodes for obvious reasons. Trey Waynes signed with Cincinnati. If they re-sign Mackenzie Alexander, then maybe they don't have as much of an urgent need for a corner, but they basically don't know who's going to play corner next year. Like, they have Mike Hughes, who's kind of sucked so far, and then they have nobody if they don't re-sign Mackenzie Alexander. And even Mackenzie Alexander was just their slot guy for the most part, so they have no clue what they're going to do at outside corner. So I can imagine them going into the second round, instead of getting a receiver to obviously replace Diggs, I think they're going to go into the second round with a defensive lineman and a corner. And they could still get a totally good receiver in the second round. I mean, they could get a really good receiver in the second round, but you're kind of boxing yourself in. You're not giving many options to yourself. And if some teams trade ahead of you and take your guys, then that's how you end up doing. Man, isn't it funny that we don't remember this trick of the Texans? I think this was still Bill O'Brien's fault too. Maybe this is why they fired the guy before him. But the Titus Howard pick, like that's how you end up.
Yeah, right after the draft, they fired their GM.
Yeah, that's how you end up making a Titus Howard kind of pick. Is like you just say, oh, we'll just get the highest ranked offensive tackle, and then Philadelphia trades ahead of you and takes Dillard, and then you're like, oh, who are the other tackles again? And you don't have a plan in place. You just take whoever is ranked highest in like CBS's prospect rankings at the position or something. If they go into the second round thinking, I don't know, like if there's so many good rookie receivers in this class that I don't even know who to cite as an example, but like they might go in thinking they're going to get somebody who's I don't know, Denzel Mims or Justin Jefferson or something, and it turns out it's like actually you're taking Van Jefferson. I don't think it'll go that badly, but that's the kind of thing that they're setting themselves up for, because BC Johnson is not good enough in my opinion. I don't think he's going to be in the league in a couple of years as more than like a wide receiver five kind of player. And everybody else they have sucks. Like, they had crap receivers going into last year. Chad Beebe is your starting slot receiver. You did a bad job. If you if Chad Beebe is your starting slot receiver, you've made grave errors managing your draft picks and your cap space.
Yeah, bottom line there. So, that's a good way of summing up. It looks like maybe some dark times ahead for Minnesota there. Let's shift our gears over to another quarterback move here with Indianapolis going ahead and getting Philip Rivers. So the end of the era for Phil Rivers in L.A. / San Diego over after many, many years. What do you expect here? Because this one kind of makes me snore.
I hear you. I think it's still – I think it's A, the best that the Colts could have done in the circumstances, and B, I'm actually kind of a little bit optimistic, or at least like since expectations are so low for Rivers at this point, I am kind of interested in buying because he just doesn't need to do that well to exceed people's expectations and the market's expectations at this point. But I think it's kind of a similar situation with Tom Brady in that, you know, these guys, Rivers is not the player that he used to be. He specifically struggles to throw the ball downfield. He has kind of a wind up heave just to get the ball downfield nowadays. And it comes at the expense of his accuracy and his velocity that he has to get this kind of like shot put kind of trajectory to get the ball as far as he needs it to go. But the thing is, whereas Tom Brady's going to an offense that seems like it's going to demand of him something that he simply can't do, I think the Colts are in better position to accommodate Rivers' limitations. And I think Frank Reich is just way ahead of Bruce Arians, at least nowadays he is. So I think that Rivers is definitely better than Jacoby Brissett. And Jacoby Brissett, I mean, he had a really bad season. He had a couple good games. I feel like Rivers will be clearly better than that. And maybe you can't really realistically hope for this, but a fully healthy season from T.Y. Hilton would really help as far as that goes. He still was really good last year before he got hurt. And he's just a great player, I think. But if they can get Paris Campbell to take a step forward, give Rivers a yards after the catch threat that he did not have with the Chargers, then I think you might all of a sudden see him kind of find a rhythm that he hasn't had in years, because and playing indoors can only help as far as that goes. But it remains to be seen, you know, like Rivers had good enough numbers last year in terms of like interceptions aside, but he was also really dependent on Austin Eckler, who had the best pass catching season of any running back since Marshall Faulk in 1999. I don't remember the specific details that I ran the query for.
I think
for,
it was like 80% catch rate and like 8 yards a target or something in that range. Something crazy like that.
Yeah, I think it was actually like 85%.
Oh my God. 9 yards,
or sorry, like 80% and 9 yards a target, something like that. But cool. Yeah, Eckler had what might have been like the most efficient pass catching season for a running back ever. And Brady looked to him – or sorry, Rivers looked to him almost obsessively. Like he was dependent on Eckler. But interestingly enough, Rivers still threw the ball pretty far downfield. Like his average depth of target was pretty far. So
they look like weather balloons when he throws it down there.
Oh,
bro.
Yeah.
It's like crazy.
Oh, totally. I just mean to say, like, that didn't really suit his abilities, and yet he did it. And Keenan Allen, Mike Williams had good enough per target numbers. I just think that Rivers might he'll lose something, I think, in the per attempt. So let's see what he had. He was 8.5, 7.8 yards per attempt, respectively, over the last 2 years. I think you'll see him drop to like 7.5, 7.6 with the Colts. But I think you'll also see him push for like 68% completion percentage, and the interceptions will come down. So I just don't think he'll need to take some of the risky throws that he did as dictated by the Chargers' offensive design. I think in Indianapolis's cases, it's more likely to be something that kind of is like, yeah, you're bad at chucking the ball that far, so why don't we just have you do something else? But yeah, I am a little concerned about no Eckler, because Nyheim Hines is the closest thing they have, and I do like Nyheim Hines as a PPR pickup because he was basically going for free in drafts, and I can imagine him catching like 60, 70 passes this year, even if he's not particularly good at it. But he's not particularly good, or at least I don't think there's any evidence that there is. So if Himes catches a lot of passes, it's basically because Rivers is checking down, and not because it's not because he's doing Austin Eckler things. And if he's not doing Austin Eckler things, then Rivers' numbers are going to come down a bit.
Okay, so maybe my analysis a little bit too simplistic here, but I think we're in a situation here where yes, like he's going into a situation where there's like a brain trust around him that was similar to like 2013 or something. And Frank Reich, obviously great and everything. But we also have a situation where Rivers, a year older, against Father Time, with, in my opinion, a worse receiving core, a obvious downgrade at his like check down at running back, with going from Eckler to Hines, like you mentioned. And again, like, I just think that we saw so much diminished skills from Rivers down the stretch. Maybe they didn't always bear out in the numbers, but what if they start to in a very significant way here? And it's not, and again, I know that moving to the dome should help, but it's not like he was playing in adverse conditions in LA either. So I really have a very low opinion of this signing. I just think that Rivers is toast, basically. And I think that this is going to end up looking like a very bad signing.
I get that, you know, he could have basically a bad season. I think he's definitely better than Jacoby Brissett. I think sure. Brissett was really bad last year. And I think this will go down as like a bad move by the Colts if they allow it to, you know, cloud their long term thinking. But I have the faith in the meantime, I guess, that they made this choice out of having no better ones. And if that's the case, then I guess I can't really blame them for taking the best thing that they could see, because it's not quite as bad as going into the year with Brissett, in my opinion. And since it's a 1 year, $25 million deal, it's like, if he sucks, who cares? They were going to have a crap quarterback anyway.
I see this going a similar way to, like, well, they're giving him the full job and everything, but the opposite of, like, Johnny Unitas moving on from Baltimore and playing one last terrible year for the Chargers.
I'm not quite brushed up on my Johnny Unitas history, so
own fault.
I'll have to defer to our Baltimore era Colts expert.
That's right.
John McKechnie. But yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. I think it maybe, for all we know, though, like, the Colts are there like, fuck, or, you know, like, this sucks, we can't do better than Rivers, but it's the best we can do.
All right, well, let's talk about some guys that maybe they could have done better with by getting. Let's get into Teddy Bridgewater and then what happens with Cam Newton next. So Bridgewater goes and gets signed by Carolina. Kind of an interesting move there. Moves within the division. You know, obviously kept things afloat for the Saints last year, but in a lot of ways, the under-the-hood numbers look a lot similar to, like, a Derek Carr. So I don't know how optimistic I am about this. For like, you know, when Matt Rhule brought Joe Brady from LSU, I think we were both in agreement, and we weren't the only ones that were excited about what this passing offense could look like, especially for Curtis Samuel. But when you have a guy who is so averse to pushing the ball down the field as Bridgewater, I just worry that Samuel, it just isn't going to happen for him under this particular regime. Whereas I think DJ Moore probably just catches like a term that you coined, like, the empty calories production aplenty.
Yeah, I was pretty skeptical of DJ Moore at his previous at his ADP up to this point in the year, but the Bridgewater signing almost makes me like a believer now. But now maybe Moore's price will just go up for it, and I'll still not be able to get any shares. Who knows? But yeah, as much as Kyle Allen left a lot of yardage on the field when throwing to Curtis Samuel, the worry with Teddy Bridgewater is that the yardage won't even be left on the field. Like, he just won't even throw to him hardly. Like, he'll throw to Samuel sometimes, and even though Samuel was more of a downfield target than Moore in this offense, like, Samuel will of course do some slot work, some underneath type plays, but the way he had upside was with respect to his downfield separation ability, and it doesn't. Whereas it didn't matter how much he got open with Allen, because Allen would just, you know, put it on the sideline every time, into the sideline, I should say. It's like Bridgewater's just going to be throwing it to either McCaffrey or Ian Thomas on that play. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely concerned for Curtis Samuel. It's to the point where I don't even know if I would draft the guy. I have no shares at this point because I was kind of just out of uncertainty fear, and now I've gone from uncertainty to certainty in my mind, and maybe that's wrong, maybe I'm being too pessimistic, but even as a Curtis Samuel fan, I just don't see the theory for how he's supposed to function in an offense like this, or at least Teddy Bridgewater would have to fundamentally change how he played relative to last year. And I don't know, maybe he will, maybe he had some, you know, justifiable reasons for being rusty last year and justifiable reasons for being anxious and kind of just a bit rattled by, you know, he was returning to a situation that he had been in his whole life, but had not been in for, what, like 4 years because of an injury that's like unprecedented,
right,
unprecedentedly catastrophic knee injury. And, you know, that's got to be a bit disorienting going from the man your whole life to considered like a, you know, borderline like cripple or something. And then all of a sudden you're expected to be Drew Brees's competent replacement. Like it's got to be a bit of a whirlwind. And maybe he was still kind of breaking out of his shell last year. But 6 yards is the average depth of target, which I don't remember ever seeing a depth of target that low over any noteworthy sample. And even though it was only 4 games or whatever, that's a big enough sample. And because the variable was so particularly low, I think it's safe to say there's real meaning behind it. So for Samuel to be good, Bridgewater specifically needs to kind of be someone he hasn't been in about 5 years. And that just seems like it's asking a lot.
It is asking a lot. And I wouldn't even say that Bridgewater was a huge downfield guy, even pre-injury. And then again, to back up the numbers, Curtis Samuel, 14.3 average depth of target last year, that ranked inside the top 15, right on par with the Will Fuller and John Brown. Do you have anything else to add onto that? Because I have some breaking news for you, if that interests you.
No, like 150 catches for like 700 yards for McCaffrey.
Okay. Love it. Okay. Some breaking news here from Adam Schefter. Quarterback trade. Jacksonville is trading quarterback Nick Foles to Chicago for the Bears' compensatory fourth round pick.
they got the Bears to trade something for Foles. That's interesting. That rules out Cam Newton to Chicago then, and I don't know what I make of Trubisky versus Foles.
It's a lot of average.
Two different kinds of sad, but one kind of sad might be less debilitating than the other, because with Trubisky and his low points last year, it was like some of the very worst, not even just football footage, it was like some of the most unnerving film I've ever seen on any subject. Granted, I'm not big on horror movies or anything, so it's not like I'm digging deep into the terror bin, but it was bad. It was like borderline sickening how bad Trubisky was at his lowest points last year, and it felt, you know, just embarrassing to watch. So Foles, however bad he is, I don't know if I can convince myself that he's capable of being that quite bad. And is also
no, he's got like a fail safe switch on.
Yeah, it's like he'll suck. He'll be terrible for you, but he won't like devolve into a baby on the football field. Like it'll just be like, this guy's a lump. This sucks. But with Trubisky, it was like, how can they let the game keep going? Like this is so. It's just horrifying to watch some of that, especially the first set half of the season for Chicago. Like Trubisky was just like, call off the fight. But with Foles, he does that annoying thing where every time we count him out, he does really good for inexplicable, like a short rate. He only does it for a short burst, mm-hmm. but he becomes like inexplicably good for the Super Bowl or the playoff run or whatever it was, or the year that he started out. That he started for the Eagles and had 27 touchdowns and 2 interceptions, replacing Michael Vick. It's like he fails in ways that like amaze you when you get any sort of hope for him, and then he makes you like question everything that you believe by coming back and doing well. And so like, you know, just hearing like how I laid that out, that all sounds so improbable, and therefore like I think it's improbable to expect him to do it a third time, you know, coming to Chicago and all of a sudden being good. But he could be still, even if he's bad, he could still be safely better than Trubisky. So I had no Trubisky shares in any best ball drafts. I'm certainly not going to get any now. I might, if I really screw up, consider Foles in like the 20th or 19th or something like that. But it will have been because I made some sort of error if I do end up in that position.
Does this boost any of the skill position guys in your mind? Like Allen Robinson, you know,
was
great last year despite Trubisky. And I thought that down the stretch, Anthony Miller started to look like the receiver that we thought he was at Memphis.
Yeah, Robinson and Miller are both good, I think. Well, Robinson's awesome, and Miller, it's not for sure yet, but I think we have reason to believe he's good now. And I think that Trubisky was as bad as Foles was last year. I still think Trubisky's a worse passer. So I think Foles has to be considered at least like a stabilizing effect for Miller and Robinson. I wouldn't argue against someone saying that it's an upgrade, especially because there's actually a history of Foles playing in an offense kind of like this. It's not that different from the Chip Kelly offense, the Nagy offense.
They know each other in Kansas City maybe a little bit too, I think.
Oh, yeah, the Reed connection generally. Yeah. I think there's reason to believe Foles is actually pretty well suited to this kind of offense. If he fits the scheme, then it's otherwise just Trubisky that he's got to worry about. And even if Foles is bad, I just think he's better than Trubisky. And I actually would consider Foles, if he's the starter, if he's declared the starter, the biggest upgrade might be for actually David Montgomery.
Did it hurt you to say that as much as it sounded like it did?
Oh, no, it doesn't hurt. It's just like Robinson already is like a fourth, fifth round range kind of pick. And I don't think you can really argue for him being higher than that. I think you can argue that his floor is higher in the event of a Foles offense. But with Montgomery, I was just kind of thinking like part of the way you have to justify Trubisky on the field is by having him run the ball. And if he's running the ball, it's carries that aren't going to Montgomery. Not generally. Like they had Montgomery with a couple big high carry counts last year, but it felt like to me that was like when they were going into the shell as an offense. I don't think it's Nagy's first inclination to just give a running back 25 carries. I think he'd rather give a running back 15 carries and mostly in the second half, kind of like Andy Reid. Mm-hmm. But with Trubisky there, it's like you have to like subsidize him with these carries that help him get into a rhythm and get the defense to give him different looks. That is his below average passing has a prayer against, but he doesn't have a prayer most of the time. And the carries that he takes, maybe you'd be better off giving those to Montgomery and then taking the remaining plays and turning them into play action passes, as opposed to, creating zone reads for Trubisky so he can convince himself that he doesn't suck. And then, drop back a couple times without completely melting down in fear. But, he had the yips last year and he's not a good enough quarterback to get the yips. So, I think going with Foles will give the offense as a whole a lot more composure, probably a better third down conversion rate, things that just kind of lend more opportunity to everybody, even if he's still well below the line of good.
And then on the other side of this, and knowing what I know about what you've done in drafts to this point in best ball, you ought to feel pretty good about your Gardner Minshew bet now.
Yeah, I honestly wasn't even worried. Maybe this is stupid of me. It wasn't even Foles that I was concerned about. I was like, what if they draft a quarterback? Or like, what if they sign Jameis Winston? Like, that could still happen, I guess. I'd be surprised if it did, though. And I think Shad Khan, the owner of the Jags, is more like a Jerry Jones than people took him for. He's not as like competitive as Jerry Jones. He's like got that cynicism, though. And I think when he saw the brand of Gardner Minshew take off, I think he was prepared to tell to put some pressure on the coaches and say, like, look, we're going with Minshew. The mustache and the headband are doing great for
it,
our
it is Duval personified.
Yeah, so I think it was pretty much like maybe he won't be good. Maybe he still gets benched because he, completely falls over in his second year. But A, I'd be surprised. And B, for a rookie to play the way he did, even if you want to stick to your guns as the prospect evaluation of Minshew and say like, oh, but he's a day three guy. He wasn't supposed to be good. This is just a fluke. It's like, still, he was uncommonly good for a rookie quarterback. And generally when a rookie quarterback is as good as him, you got to stick with them. And it could go the way of Mariota or whoever else who had a good start to their career and fell apart. But you basically have to find out if that's really what you have to find out. Like you can't pass up that seventh round contract. The possibility of having a viable starting quarterback on a seventh round contract is such a unique asset if you can secure that. And now they have to see if they can.
Absolutely. So excited to see his development here in year two. Easy guy to root for. So let's move on to some of those notable free agent guys. I mean, I feel like we're running out of spots at the table here as far as starting quarterbacks go. And then we're going to have the infusion of, depending on whether Tua is ready to go this year, but, we're going to have three potential rookie starting quarterbacks, maybe four. So what happens with Cam Newton and Jameis Winston in your mind as potential landing spots, and how does this maybe impact how you view the top of the draft playing out?
Yeah, I have no idea what to make of the Cam Newton and Jameis Winston situations, because I have a much higher opinion of Cam Newton than most people do, and to me, the choice between him and Winston is not a serious question whatsoever normally, but still don't know what to make of Cam Newton's foot. We don't know what Washington's role might be. Like, that's the other angle here, is like, maybe it's not even just Cam versus Jameis. It might be Cam versus Dwayne Haskins versus Jameis insofar as Washington's specific involvement relative to Cam. So if Cam gets traded for by Washington, then Haskins goes to the bench and Jameis probably signs with the Chargers. Or maybe not. Maybe they don't sign anybody and they just take the leftover of Tua or Herbert at the sixth overall pick. I projected the Chargers to take Tua because I projected Herbert to go to the Dolphins at five. But, you know, they have Tyrod Taylor as an option in the meantime. They might, if Jameis Winston is just a bridge to the next quarterback that they draft, they already have the bridge. Mm-hmm. It's Tyrod Taylor. So I don't know if like Jameis might just kind of not be a starter this year.
Man, that's crazy. He's got the LASIK, man. Like, he's going to be good now.
Come on, it's totally safe this time. Yeah. He's totally different. I don't even have a strong opinion on it. I don't blame anyone for swearing off Jameis. I don't blame anyone for having some lingering, stubborn hope. I don't really want to get involved either way. I'm just kind of like, I'm focusing on other quarterbacks. But, you know, if Washington wants Cam, and they do, and if the Chargers consider Tyrod their stopgap, and if they consider the rookie that a rookie, I should say, it's not foregone that they take one. But if they choose, if they know right now that they want one, there's just not much point in taking Winston unless you're going to do something where you try to sign him to a 1-year deal and turn him into a comp pick, which would make sense, I guess. But I don't know if it's like, I just don't know what their intentions are. And Anthony Lynn is a culture guy, so I can imagine him not liking the idea of Jameis Winston, supreme clown man, joining the team. So it's one of those things where I wouldn't be that shocked if Winston actually doesn't sign a contract with a team, because he's not the kind of guy you like. What's the point of having him as a backup if he's the antithesis of stability, and if he's going to bring kind of a hoopla with him that isn't really worth the time? I don't really know. I think he might just kind of
let him mentor Jarrett Stidham in New England.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I can't see New England considering Jameis. I think Bill would go with Mohamed Sanu at quarterback before he would Jameis Winston.
And then he would sign Cam and reconvert him to a tight end like he was at Florida.
I don't know. I don't want to make this sound like it's reporting, because it definitely isn't. It's just me and stupid.
We can be wearing our tinfoil hats for this. It's fine.
Oh, I already am. Was I not supposed
to? I wore mine.
Okay, good, good. You should. You should never take it off. But I think that New England and Washington might both be on Cam, or at least like New England's watching to see and could give an offer, because I think Belichick could use Cam. I don't think he can use Jameis Winston. And what are they going to do anyway? Like, I just don't think Jameis is an option, and they don't have – I don't think Stidham's an option either. I just don't think he's any good. So
that was weird to watch on Twitter yesterday morning, like that a Stidham hive still exists.
Yeah, I didn't know there was one.
It didn't seem ironic enough. So I think it was serious.
Yeah, I thought the Stidham hive went out of business when he transferred from Baylor, but I guess not. Yeah, I'm not interested in that, and I have to believe Belichick isn't either. So – if they don't get Cam, I don't really know what they're going to do. I think he would much sooner tank than deal with Winston for a year. And I think it would be a very Belichickian outcome generally if he somehow came out in 2021 with Trevor Lawrence and, you know, just restarted the whole misery machine on the rest of us.
Let's not talk that into existence. Okay. All right. That's gonna round out the quarterbacks then.
Positive vibes only.
Yeah. Before I get too frazzled on the air, why don't we just why don't we move on to some of the skill position movement or lack thereof here over the last few days. So Amari Cooper signs that big deal to stay in Dallas. So any thoughts there? I mean, it just feels like that deal was a long time coming.
Yeah, Dallas almost screwed it up. They had to use the franchise tag on Dak because they have already screwed that up. I don't know how they're going to keep him long term, and if he holds out, they're screwed. They can't do anything. But Cooper, I think, is worth that contract. I think he's a really, really good receiver, and I know he doesn't have he doesn't have that workhorse ability of like a DeAndre Hopkins, but he's one of those guys who, if you just need one play to get made, he's about as dangerous as anybody. And I know that people fixate on the drop passes and the injuries last year were concerning, but he showed too when he was healthy that it's like, this is upside worth chasing. And more importantly for Dallas's long-term, you know, resource management, it's like, you can't let that guy walk after spending a first round pick trading for him. So I think it was at once probably like a painful amount of money to cough up for Dallas, but I thought they were basically compelled to do it with the kind of corner they forced themselves into.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point regarding like what they gave up to get him, that they had to keep him long term. So we'll see what the long term future as a result with Dak and everything is, because like you said, they seem to be mismanaging that one pretty badly. Speaking of this mismanagement, let's get on to the Texans side of things. David Johnson, what do we think?
It's tough because you would think that Bill O'Brien, if he wanted David Johnson so bad, you would think that he on some level knows who David Johnson is and has like a appropriate idea of how to use him. But Bill O'Brien has never used a running back that way. He could have used a running back like Duke Johnson similarly to how he should use David Johnson, and he basically declined to last year. So I'm worried that O'Brien might just kind of try to use David Johnson the same way he did Carlos Hyde last year, which he would fail miserably at. Like, David Johnson is not even an average pure runner, or at least he's not average. He's not even an average runner out of the backfield. Like, he's dangerous in the open field because he's fast and athletic and he's powerful, but be it the vision or the change of direction, the start stop, I don't know what, he's never been able to generate much explosiveness on the ground. It's always been as a pass catcher where he really stood out. Now, I still think you can make him a really useful running back, but you have to be willing to use him as a route runner specifically. Like, you have to understand he will be average at best as a pure runner. So if you're imagining better than average returns, you have to use him as a pass catcher. And I don't know if O'Brien's smart. I don't know if Ryan's curious enough, let alone smart enough to have any of these things occur to him. So if he tries to just plug in David Johnson to the Carlos Hyde role, you're going to get something kind of similar to Arizona's season last year, I think, where it's just like, wow, these other guys are better at this than David Johnson. And even Cliff Kingsbury, I was disappointed with how he used David Johnson. He tried to just kind of use him out of the backfield where he still drew a lot of targets, to be fair. He was still a good pass catcher last year, but you use David Johnson at his best by giving him 14 to 15 carries per game, ideally getting him outside on a bunch of those carries, and you give him actual wide receiver snaps on the other ones. Like, go ahead, run screens, throw it to him out of the backfield like you would normally, but specifically you need to get him wide receiver snaps and motion him out of the backfield, have him run routes against linebackers. Like, he kills defenses when you do that. And Cliff Kingsbury largely did not do that. Maybe Bill O'Brien will. I don't know. It's just one of those things. Like, why would we give Bill O'Brien the benefit of the doubt? And exactly. even if you do give him the benefit of the doubt, do you want to pay a fourth or a fifth round pick to test David Johnson's durability? And do you want to find out at that price whether the guy who got outplayed by Kenyon Drake and Chase Edmonds last year can be the player that he was 4 years ago? It's a lot of risk, in my opinion. And I still like David Johnson. It's like, if his health were assured, and if I could have a sit down with Bill O'Brien and figure out just how stupid he is really, and if it's not as bad as I feared, then I would be like, okay, yeah, David Johnson, I like how this could set up, especially with that target void with Hopkins gone. It's like, they could really, he could really be part of the solution. I just don't know if Bill O'Brien's capable of conceiving one.
So then on the other side, in Arizona, is Kenyon Drake someone that you would like? I'll give you a quick toss up here between Drake versus, let's say, Leonard Fournette and Josh Jacobs.
Those, the latter two definitely are way ahead of Drake for me. Drake's been going, I want to say, at like the second, third round turn in best ball drafts on best ball tens. I don't know if the Johnson trade will make him go higher as a result. If I'm so, I think that
19,
would be
round pick 19 dating back to Monday.
That's not good. Yeah, I feel like people are they're not thinking that through correctly, because his price all along should have been based on the assumption that David Johnson would not be there. If they were pricing him at the second and third round turn while still believing David Johnson was in the picture, then they weren't properly considering his risk at that point. And to raise him to 19 in response to David Johnson getting traded, I think is – it's kind of like the combine thing, you know, where it's like, don't count something a second time.
Yeah,
if a guy who's supposed to be really fast turns out to be really fast, it's like you count it as a negative if the guy is supposed to be very fast and it turns out he isn't, or you count it as a positive if a guy wasn't supposed to be very fast, but he is. But with Kenyon Drake, you should have only been able to justify at second, third round turn under the condition that Johnson isn't there. So if Johnson is confirmed not there, it's not a reason to raise him further. So at 19, I am not considering that one bit. I'm not low on Fournette and Jacobs, but I don't have any shares of either. And I would take them. I don't know. I would need like 85 shares of those two before I would consider putting Drake for the final 15 at a top 20 price tag.
Okay, I'm glad that we got that out of the way there, because I was wondering what your thoughts on Drake were, you know, relative to the market, especially after all of that. So not counting it twice, I think, it is a really great way of framing that. Let's move on to a slightly more underrated or under the radar signing here, but Kenyon Drake's former team, the Dolphins, went ahead and picked up Jordan Howard.
Yeah, this is one of those that are kind of one of those signings that are kind of like non-indicative. Like, they don't necessarily mean anything, but they could mean something, because Miami's probably on a more than 1 year tank plan. Like, they're going to, you know, they're competing. They've been competing all along. If they were truly trying to tank, they wouldn't have beat the Patriots in week 17 last year. But they know what they're doing. They know they need to kind of accumulate spending assets, and Jordan Howard is the kind of guy who he can do just enough to give them that veneer of competitiveness without making it seem like they're quitting. And to be fair, they're not. They could have signed someone worse than Jordan Howard. They're getting a pretty good pure runner. It's just that he doesn't have the durability, and he doesn't have like the pass catching ability to project as like a solution in the long term, which means that he's subject to getting marginalized in the short term if something better comes along. And I think at this point, we're kind of just waiting to see, will the Dolphins draft someone like Jonathan Taylor in the first round of the draft?
Because that's what I'm guessing.
If so, then all of a sudden, you know, Jordan Howard's just a really good backup to have. If they don't draft Jonathan Taylor in the first round, and they don't draft Swift or Clyde Edwards-Helaire, whoever it is, then maybe they just go into next year with Jordan Howard as the running back, and maybe they're content to see how that goes. And, you know, maybe they're thinking, you know, worst case scenario, we got Howard and we got Laird for the passing downs, and that should be good enough for a team with our ambitions. And it'd be totally reasonable to say all of that. But yeah, it's one of those things where, as far as whether to invest in Jordan Howard at this point, I don't know if it should actually raise his ADP that much. Like, he had kind of a wide range. He was always pretty cheap up to this point, but you'd have someone like me who would sometimes take him in like the 14th or 15th. And then in other drafts, especially if someone like me isn't in it, he could fall to like the 16th, 17th, 18th round. And I probably won't be buying if this signing makes Howard jump to like the 12th or 10th, because I just they have so many draft picks. I really would not be surprised to see like Swift or Edwards-Helaire or Jonathan Taylor, Cam Akers, whoever, somebody. And it wouldn't be surprising either if they signed another free agent running back. Like, there's still guys out there like Devontae Freeman and Lamar Miller, and they're not going to cost anything. So it wouldn't be shocking if Howard got some competition even before the draft. So I'd be a little careful not to chase him too much. But, you know, if he doesn't get competition that pushes him out of the starting lineup, he could be a real good pick this year, because he still is a good runner. He's not like a breakaway runner. He's not an agile, exciting, elusive runner, but he generates yardage very reliably. And you know, a team like the Dolphins, they're going to have usage up for grabs in the backfield. The question is just like what people are going to compete for it. And if the competition is between Jordan Howard, Patrick Laird, and Miles Gaskin, I know who's leading that backfield in rushing yardage.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a matter, like you said, of what the rest of the offseason has in store for that Dolphins backfield. And then looking at the current ADPs right now, dating back to Monday, he's going in the same neighborhood around pick 130 right now as Alexander Mattison, Chase Edmonds, Justice Hill. So that kind of gives you an idea of the type of running backs around there that you could be investing in.
Yeah, I would take him over those guys, but the kind of like trick answer to that question is that, but I'm not taking any running backs there probably. Like, yeah. I'm probably targeting some other position because I hate that range of the draft for running backs in general.
Okay. Yeah, that's your Jarwin zone. I get it.
It's the Jarwin zone, absolutely.
Okay, so let's move on. Speaking of tight ends here before we sign off, a couple of moves here. So Austin Hooper gets signed by the Browns, and then the Falcons replace Hooper with Hayden Hurst. So let's get into that, starting with Hooper.
Yeah, I didn't really like the signing that much. Like, Hooper's a good player, but his calling card is his efficiency and his reliability underneath. And he, at his best, kind of still resembled to me not much more than like Jacob Tammy with the Broncos or something like that. He's just kind of a Jacob Tammy, Dennis Pitta kind of player, probably better than them both, but not by enough to justify, in my opinion, spending as much on him as Cleveland did, because he's not really a blocker. He's kind of one dimensional, and within that one dimension, he doesn't have a downfield threat. Like he's almost half dimensional in a way, because his one dimension is as a pass catcher, but you can't use him just like every way as a pass catcher. He's just kind of like a curl route kind of guy. He's more underneath than anything. He's very reliable in that range. Like, he had a really high catch rate and yards for his low yards per target. He had a very high catch rate. He kind of had like a Michael Thomas at tight end thing going on, where it's like he's not taking the top off the defense, but he generates first downs as well as basically anybody in recent years. My worry is that a part of that was probably like the byproduct of playing next to Julio Jones and even Calvin Ridley. And as much as I still think Odell Beckham is awesome, I don't think that going to Cleveland will be quite the same scenario. So I think that whereas Hooper was well above the baseline in Atlanta in terms of efficiency and reliability, he had no explosiveness even then. So I think going to a higher difficulty scenario like Cleveland is one where he will drift downward toward the baseline in terms of efficiency, and there still won't be any more explosiveness. So it's just a classic case, in my opinion, of overpaying. Like, he'll still be a good player, but I just don't see the reason to chase what he offers. But he's a much better pass catching threat in the meantime, at least underneath, than David Njoku. But that's also part of the reason why I don't like the signings, because like, David Njoku was a player they should have known would need development time. He was a 20-year-old rookie, and tight ends always take longer to develop, and they took him with no intention of waiting. Like, how, or at least, I don't know, the new regime, I guess that was a Sashi pick. But you know, it's like Sashi wouldn't have made this signing basically. So I hate it.
Okay. All right. Well, that sums it up pretty well then. So yeah, it's a muddy situation in Cleveland, and I don't know. I have some maybe baseless optimism that, you know, I'm going to kind of throw last year out with the bathwater and believe in what I saw more so down the stretch for the Browns in 2018 than thinking that this collection of talent is more along the lines of what we saw on the field last year. So maybe things start to click, but I don't know with the introduction of that second tight end into the equation, you know, whether two of those guys can function together, whether one of them wins out. You'd almost imagine at this point that the Browns want to make that Hooper contract start paying off right away.
Oh yeah.
Like you said, it's a big one, and you know, they do have Njoku on a rookie deal even still. So
you know what, sorry, the Hooper signing specifically displaces Kareem Hunt's second half role. He was basically playing like an H-back in that offense, and now they're not going to have room for that. So they're going to have to either like split carries between Chubb and Hunt, or they're going to have to make Hunt basically a, you know, a 20% of snaps kind of player. And they're doing – both of those sound bad to me, by the way.
And they gave Hunt a second-round tender, is that right?
Right. Yeah, so it's like I don't know what they think they're going to do unless they cut Jarvis Landry or trade Odell Beckham. It's like there's just no usage to make these assets give a return that's worth what they're spending on them.
Yeah, so kind of a rough setup there in that sense. So we'll see what shakes out there, and then let's finish it out. Your favorite topic, Hayden Hurst.
Yeah, he's so good. Yeah, I don't really know what it is with the NFL and Hayden Hurst, but it's like David Hasselhoff in Germany or something. Like they just this inexplicable thing where they're all huge fans, and it's not the case anywhere else in the world. And it's bizarre, but you know, whatever. It's a good trade for the Ravens. That's a bailout, by the way. When you take Hayden Hurst 25th overall, seven picks before Lamar Jackson, and then 2 years later you get a second round pick for it, that's charity on the part of the Falcons, who are a dumb team and they're doing a bad job in every respect and have been for years. So but it's good for the Ravens that teams like the Falcons exist, because otherwise they'd probably just have to cut Hurst after this year, because he's not – no one's paying a first-round contract to their third tight end. So Hurst, first of all, he was going in like the last round, 18th round of best ball draft. So if you drafted him in that range, you got a clear value, because even if he's bad, basically any starting Atlanta Falcons tight end is going to pay off at that price. And as much as I don't think Hurst is worth a first-round pick – and certainly not worth taking ahead of Lamar Jackson, he can do some stuff. It's like if he had been a fourth round pick, I would have had no problem with it. Right. But yeah, first round, stupid people, bad at thinking generally, and bad at identifying good football players, bad at figuring out which way the wind is blowing, etc. But he's going to get work, and he was a very cheap pick up until now. So I probably won't get any shares, unfortunately, because I'm assuming his price tag is going to jump up to the 12th round or something like that, in which range I still much prefer TJ Hawkinson and Blake Jarwin. Probably even prefer Ian Thomas over, at least in PPR, I probably prefer Ian Thomas in PPR over Hurst. But yeah, he could be, he's going to be a top 15 tight end. The question is, does he push for like the top 8? Top 12, what kind of upside he has week to week, things like that.
The thing about him is like the unknown, because he had a total washout as a rookie, and then, you know, it's nobody basically in the league except for two or three guys was going to get like the targets over Mark Andrews in that offense a year ago. So
yeah,
there's the unknown element, but there is also the advanced age variable that you talk about as well. So, you know, how much room for skills growth is there really versus, none. You know, the relative inexperience at the NFL level? Like, he's football young in that sense. So we'll see. I don't expect him to like replicate Hooper's numbers one to one or anything like that. But I think you have like a very, you know, logical framing of it, where like he will be like a useful player in two tight end leagues, and someone that, you know, that can be rostered in 12 team leagues.
Yeah, I think he could be a useful starter in not like as in a league winner type, but a glue guy, like a starting PPR tight end who, if you lose this year, it's not because of him necessarily. It's not because of him. But yeah, actually, the Hayden Hurst trade, I think there's greater significance even in Mark Andrews' respect, because he only played 467 snaps last year and he still had 800 yards and 10 touchdowns. That's like 500 fewer snaps than Zach Ertz, who had basically the same fantasy point total. So clearing out Hurst clears a path for Andrews to push for 700 snaps. And if you don't, if you project substantial regression on a per snap basis, he still projects as a clear top three tight end in that case, in my opinion. And I think he's my tight end too. I'm not considering Kittle over Andrews, especially when Andrews is at least so far cheaper by a couple rounds.
Yeah, I like that call a lot. You're obviously preaching to the choir on that one. So that's going to round things out for today's show. Do you have any shows or movies that you're watching that those of us who are socially isolating could pass the time with?
Oh, man. Man, there's the list of like what I'm watching right now, which is, you know, I'm kind of being strategic. I'm trying to save the best of some things for last. So I'm kind of
I watched a Leprechaun movie yesterday. So like, yeah.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of Top Chef, and this is not to say like that's kind of a disposable show to me. I'm rewatching It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, not because it's disposable, but because I've seen it already. But yeah, I'm eventually probably, you know, especially depending on how the quarantine turns here, I might go into some Twin Peaks kind of spooky territory, or if I need a lift, or if I'm not rattled by the real life symmetry otherwise, I might watch The Last Man on Earth again, just because I love Will Forte. I've already watched like all the Tim Robinson stuff 500 times in the past couple of weeks, but which, by the way, John, you need to watch the Tim Robinson the characters episode.
Oh yeah, I'm reporting back on that shortly.
So funny, so good.
Okay, I'm trying to think if I have any worthwhile recommendations that haven't already been, like, you know, tossed out there on Twitter. I don't know. I've sort of like how you've been rewatching Always Sunny. I've been rewatching Archer. I forgot how funny that show was, especially in its earlier season. So if you need like some lighthearted comedy, like while it's on, while you're like working from home, that's a good one. I wouldn't recommend the Leprechaun movie that I saw, though.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to rewatch the Venture Brothers at some point in this thing. That's like a religious experience for me whenever I go back into the Venture Brothers. And, you know, these circumstances allow me to properly immerse myself.
Yeah, they absolutely do. So if there is even a sliver of silver lining in this, at least there's some of that. But Mario, really appreciate you taking the time and recording this episode. Glad we got to sit down and do this. We will be given periodic updates on Twitter as to when we'll be putting out these podcasts over these next couple of weeks and everything like that. But otherwise, that's going to wrap things up for today's show. For Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thanks for listening to the RotoWire NFL podcast.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. In hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.